Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, shalom. This is Richard Address, and it gives me great pleasure to welcome you again to today's installment of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. These shows represent our desire to explore issues and events that help shape and comment on the current revolution in longevity and how that revolution is impacting our families, ourselves, and our Jewish world at large. We invite you to share comments and ideas with us at Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com or on our Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. We invite you to go there and like it or whatever. And if you'd like to be a part of our conversation, we invite you to jot down this phone number and call in. Our producer, Steve, will be happy to greet you and place you in the queue. The call-in number is 646-668-8763. That's 646-668-8763. We have a very, very interesting show for you today. We're at a little bit of the mercy of traffic in Los Angeles for one of our guests, Rabbi Jason Wiener from Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, who has just written this brand new book, Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision-Making, published by Urim, U-R-I-M, Publishers. And we're waiting for him to call in, but we also are very honored to have in studio, right next to me, Dr. Warren Brandwein, who teaches bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. And so today's theme really is a conversation about the emerging impact of medical technology on longevity, some of the challenges, some of the ethical challenges, from both a Jewish perspective and from the clinical and practical perspective when you teach your students at the University of Pennsylvania here in Philly. So welcome, Dr. Brandwein. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Rabbi.
And what's the hottest topic that you're teaching the kids, the students, or not kids anymore, students? You know, what's the one or two things that come up all the time?
One thing that comes up all the time is the cost of medical care. Trying to get figure out how we're going to pay for all this. We have an aging population. We have some marvelous technologies. We have some wonder drugs, and sometimes you wonder how the drug companies charge what they do. And the prices keep going up of all of our medical care, and nobody knows how to pay for this. And so that's really an important topic. Also, there's genetic testing. We do prenatal testing, and we find conditions that may or may not be fatal. And then the question is, what do you do about them? Do you continue the pregnancy? Do you not continue the pregnancy? Do you go through major surgery? Do you not? And there are some real ethical problems here.
The genetic testing thing, I know that that comes up increasing. But let me ask you a question then, as we're waiting for Rabbi Wiener. There's this the commercial companies through, I think, some of the genealogy companies, 23andMe, and that if you send in a sample of DNA, they'll track all of your ancestry and then the diseases that you're prone to. And people, I've known people who are starting to use this. What's the ethics behind it? Is it just my ego? I want to know where I've come from, or I'm sure you've discussed this in class about, well, what happens if all of a sudden I see I have something that may come up, and I wasn't prepared for that.
It's a problem because nobody has figured out the ethics. We figured out the science, but the ethics that go with it, we don't know. So people go to the doctor with these reports, and they say, okay, now what do I do? And the doctor says, I don't know. And people are stuck with information that nobody knows what to do with. We spoke before we went on air about the BRCA testing for breast cancer.
Right.
So Angelina Jolie has her bilateral mastectomy, and a lot of women are following that. Is that the right thing to do? We don't know yet.
Yeah. And we were talking, in fact, we just posted on the Jewish Sacred Aging website this morning about this article from Sunday's New York Times about Alzheimer's and the possibility of blood tests showing eventually that, you know, you may be a candidate for that. And again, the ethical question of what do you do with the information once you have the information? So it appears from Steve on the other side of the control room that Rabbi Wiener is there. So, or wherever you are, Rabbi Wiener, are you on the line? Let me put it that way.
Hi. Yes.
Hi. Morning. Hi. How nice to see you. Nice to see you, or nice to speak with you, Rabbi.
Likewise. Sorry for the delay.
No. Listen, I lived in L.A., so as long as you didn't have to get on the 405, the 10, the 5, the 110, or any of the other variations on the freeway theme, you then have to deal with the surface streets, which at this time of day where you are can be crazy. Anyway, nice to hear your voice.
Yeah.
Thank you. Just relax.
Likewise. Thank you for having me on. It's quite an honor.
Hell, thank you. Have a cup of coffee. Relax.
Yeah.
Have a rugelach or something. Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision Making is the book. It's a great book. Dr. Brandwine,
thank
who's
you.
Here. We were just talking again on air and how much we enjoyed going through the book. It's a meaty book. And I guess and in your capacity as the director of spiritual care at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, let me ask you the basic, easy question. What motivated you to do this?
Yeah, that is a great question. You know, personally, I was sort of thrown into chaplaincy when I was in rabbinical school. When I graduated, the rotation that we were obligated to do in chaplaincy, the one thing I wrote down in my evaluation that I learned from it was that I didn't want to be a chaplain. And,
you know, that's like
later,
that old, it's like the old Yiddish expression, man plans and God laughs.
You know? Exactly.
And the rabbinate, exactly. We get to know that. Welcome to the club. Welcome to the club. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right. I mean, it's life, you know, you just kind of follow the path where it takes you sometimes. And, you know, I was very happy in a synagogue. And then unfortunately, my predecessor here at Cedars-Sinai, who was a member of our shul, got sick. And I came to fill in for him and just kind of give him some coverage so he could recover. Unfortunately, he did not recover. That's Rabbi Levi Meir of blessed memory. Mm-hmm. And after, you know, covering for him for a couple of years, I really fell in love with the work. And before I knew it, I was hired to be here full time. And then the types of questions and ethical dilemmas and challenging scenarios that I was faced with were really throwing me for a loop. And it was really challenging. It was very difficult. It was exciting and profound. But I found myself in real life and death frontline issues. And so I was looking for, you know, guidance, and I had great people to speak to, and that was helpful. And there are a lot of wonderful books out there, but a lot of them are either very, very long, encyclopedic, and just difficult to look things up, or just contain so much information that it's difficult to find guidance. Many of them are very philosophical or academic, and they're not intended to be practical guides. And so as I was encountering issues, the way I learn, I mean, and everyone has a different style, is by kind of trying to write things down and summarize them and kind of put it into a palatable format for myself. And so really, I started writing notes for myself every time I would deal with different situations, and certain things started to come up most frequently, and I would sometimes share the notes with other people or seek feedback. And then every now and then I was asked to publish something, and I had these notes, so I'd publish it as an article in a journal. And before I knew it, I really felt like I had developed something that could be helpful to a lot of people, is what I needed, and it was helpful to me. And so I started to realize that perhaps it could be a book, and I started to work on that, not realizing how much work it is to put out,
yes,
to publish a book.
Yeah.
But I got so far into it at a certain point where I said, okay, you know, I'm going to finish this.
Well, finish it, you did. It's a really nice piece of work, so mazel tov. And if somebody
Thank
wants to get a
much.
Hold of it, how does one go to the great God Amazon?
I mean, it is available discounted on Amazon. It's on the Urim website as well, and many Jewish bookstores. But yeah, it's on Amazon.
Okay, and the publisher is Urim, which is URIM, and their website is urim.org or com or whatever. You know,
it's urimpublishers.com.
Urim Publishers, okay. So
urimpublications.com.
Publication, cool.
Yeah.
And so let me go to one of the questions that comes up, as you know, in the rabbinate, and I'm sure this comes up Dr. Brandwein in class as well. We're taught, you know, the value of life, l'chaim, the Jewish value of life, is the maintenance of life an absolute value within Judaism? Must it be preserved at all costs? Or walk me through the boundaries if that would say, yeah, once you reach this point, you know, if you continue to be aggressive, and you're really taking away from a person's dignity. What, you know, Jason, walk us through very, very quickly. You deal with this all the time at the hospital. How do we approach this Jewishly?
Sure. I'll tell it to you the way I often tell family members of patients. There is a conception. There is I might even call it a misconception, though it's not totally wrong, but there is a conception that people have out there that Judaism says life is of infinite value. And it is true that many Jewish bioethicists, one of the critiques we sometimes have of the principalist, the secular principalist approach, you know, of non-maleficence and beneficence and autonomy and justice, is that they left out the value of life, as just as you said. And from a Jewish perspective, we see great value in life, and that's not just value, actually, sanctity of life. It's even more than value. But I there is kind of like two schools of thought. There is that school of thought that says life is of infinite value, but there's also a school of thought which we could call that life is of relative value. I mean, it's hard to say that all life is really of infinite value, especially when we know in the Torah there are things that supersede life. If someone holds a gun to your head and says, you know, worship this idol, Jewish law actually says, you know, you rather die than worship the idol. If it says, kill this person or I'll kill you, we don't kill the person. There are times when we give up our life for a higher value. And so we can say that life is of relative value. It's of extreme sanctity. It's very holy. And we do everything we can to prolong life, but we don't prolong the dying process. We don't prolong suffering. We can't hasten death, but at a certain point, we allow death to occur, and we favor a compassionate approach to ensuring that there's palliative care, that the person doesn't suffer, and that they'd be allowed to die with dignity.
So is it safe to say, and from my work in this field with Jewish sacred aging, that across the denominational lines, we are in favor as an American Jewish community of palliative care, hospice care, comfort care? Would that be a correct statement?
Yes, definitely. We are in favor of it. I mean, there are going to be different nuances. So, for example, in the Orthodox community, you'll often find hospices that try to gear themselves or market towards Orthodox community. And what they specifically market is that they are willing to provide some kinds of interventions, basic biological maintenance, like nutrition and hydration, and sometimes antibiotics, sometimes even a little bit more, but not necessarily curative or aggressive interventions. But so there's different nuances of how aggressive we are even on hospice, but you can definitely say that, yes, across the line, we believe in comfort and helping people to die as pain-free as possible. Yeah.
Dr. Brandwein, on this, the concept of futile care, which comes up in class, when you teach this end of life, power of life and the boundaries of that, how do you approach this with your students?
Look, I want to go about this in a backwards way first.
Fine. It's we're Jewish.
We want people to write living, not necessarily living wills, but we want to know what people's feelings are about end-of-life care. What do you do, Rabbi, about the patient who says, I want the last quarter going into the breathing machine? And this is not necessarily his last quarter. It's our last quarter. It's Medicare, Medicaid, the insurance company, to pay for futile care. Is there a Jewish approach to this? Do we say enough is enough?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. I mean, it's difficult. You're right. I mean, even though I am advocating for an approach that does not necessarily push very aggressive end-of-life interventions, there are times when, you know, I did say we don't hasten death and we don't necessarily withdraw interventions at the end of life. And this can lead to a conflict when a person is being supported on artificial interventions. It's expensive, and there's justice issues. There's other people that need the machines, and it's a challenge. We do try to protect people's decisions, and if people are trying to have their lives prolonged because of their beliefs, their valid, religious perspectives, we try to defend that at all reasonable costs. So we're as long as it's reasonable. So for example, brain death. There are many in the Orthodox community, for example, who don't see death by neurological criteria as a definition of death. But the United States, we do. In California, we do see that as a definition. So if we have someone in our ICU, which is not just taking up space and nursing and machines, but it's $30,000-$40,000 a day. And according to American law, they are a corpse, but according to their family, they are a living, breathing human being. So we give them reasonable accommodation, which means like a couple of days. We do try to accommodate, but there's a limit, and it can only go so far. And we try to strike that balance.
Aren't there
because, case by case, they're not easy.
Right. And you just alluded to this. I think one of the gifts of Jewish tradition is that, and my understanding of the tradition is that it really does approach things on a case by case basis. That doesn't say that there has to be one rule for everybody. I think the uniqueness concept of one of the gifts of Jewish tradition is the uniqueness of every individual with Tzelem Elohim in God's image. And that extends when I teach this and work with families, to every single case. I'm sure you deal with this almost every single day in the hospital.
Yeah, definitely. Every case is different. Every family is different. I mean, just because someone says they're Orthodox, or if someone says they're Sephardic, or whatever they say is their label, you really don't know that much about them going in. Each family is unique. They have their own dynamics. They have their own way of interpreting Jewish law. And each medical situation has its own nuances.
So, Dr. Brandwein, in the follow-up then, in your conversation with students, what, do you sense from a student's perspective more of the aggressive approach until they actually get out to the field and have to deal with this in a real clinical, everyday, day-to-day thing?
What I'm finding is that the students are very much in favor of enough is enough.
Really?
They're very, if somebody leaves a living will or durable power of attorney with an understanding that when I reach a point where my life is not productive, it's not useful, I'm not interactive, then it's enough. And they do not feel that this continuing care, which they consider futile care, the vast majority of them are okay with. It's enough, stop, turn it off, let them go.
We're speaking with Dr. Warren Brandwein from the University of Pennsylvania, who teaches bioethics, and Rabbi Jason Wiener, the special guest today, whose new book, Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision Making, now available on Amazon and published by Urim, U-R-I-M, Publications. Jason, in your book, you talk in the beginning about something called authoritative versus authoritarian tension. Could you explain that, what that meant?
Yeah, sure. Basically, what I was talking about there is that, the way collaborative decision-making happens in the hospital, which might be different than in some, personal religious communities, is that it is important to receive guidance and, nuanced, intelligent guidance, but it often doesn't work when it's, enforced and pushed on people. We give people space to make decisions, but informed decisions.
You talk also in the same section about something called collaborative decision making. My sense is, in talking to your colleagues as I go around the country and physicians, that this concept now of really a team approach to decision making in the hospital seems to be more popular, if that's the right word. I mean, could you just speak to that? I mean, Jason, talk to me, start us off. What do you mean by this collaborative decision making? Is it really the team approach, everybody coming together?
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. You know, ethicists in the hospital, sometimes people think when we sit down with a family meeting, the ethicist is there to tell them, you know, what's ethical, what's unethical, what to do, what you can't do. And really, they are, you know, architects of moral space. They're there to help lay out the issues and help people figure out kind of the parameters and the dilemmas. You know, it used to be that there was, you know, a time in medicine which was much more patriarchal, or, you know, it was sort of the doctor told you what you could do and what you can't do, and people just kind of listened. But we have also gone through an era where people want to have a little bit more autonomy in their decision-making process. But the challenge with that is that the decisions that come up in modern hospitals are so complex and so excruciating. They're so difficult. And when you add to that the difficulty with making decisions that people anyways have, you know, it's hard to make rational decisions, and especially under stress, especially in a foreign environment when you don't understand all the medical lingo, and there's grief and, you know, family issues that kind of creep up. So people have a hard time making decisions, but to make a proper decision, it's not just a medical decision. So you can't just turn back to the doctor and say, no, doc, you tell me what to do, because there might be religious issues, but then there might also be psychosocial issues, and then there's family issues. And so there's different specialists. A person might be suffering from a cardiac issue, but it also brings up neurological issues. And so we try to bring into the room, so to speak, literally or figuratively, but oftentimes literally in the same room, you know, a broad, diverse group that can help kind of bring up all the issues to help walk people through the decision-making process with these very complicated modern dilemmas. You know, we call them dilemmas, not problems, because problems oftentimes, you know, have a solution. With dilemmas, usually we're looking for the least bad option. You know, there's no perfect, easy solution.
In the old days, doctors told the patient what to do or didn't tell them anything. But it has become very difficult to keep secrets because of the team approach to medicine. You can't get the cardiologist and neurologist and kidney specialist and the nurse and the dietitian all agreeing to keep a secret. So the truth will come out, and everybody has their opinion. And what we're doing now in biomedical ethics is using mediation as opposed to arbitration, negotiation. We use a process called mediation to see if we can get the doctors, the family, the nursing staff all on the same page. It's not easy. And it's very difficult to keep your own open-mindedness about this. Obviously, no matter how hard I try, I have feelings about what's going on. I have feelings about what should be done. And sometimes that leaks into the process. But we try to get everybody to come to an agreement. And then there's always that family where the major players involved are in agreement, and then the son from Arizona who hasn't seen his mother in 15 years comes in and says, you're going to do what? You're going to take the machines away? You're going to kill my mother? Are you crazy? I'm going to call the newspaper. I'm going to get my lawyer. And what you think you've finally come to a decision, and somebody throws a wrench in the works.
Yeah, and I think all of us have walked that walk. Rabbi Wiener, I'm sure you... I've seen that too many times within the context, especially, you know, as Dr. Brandwein is saying, somebody just arrives from LAX and walks into your hospital and, you know, promulgates something off the wall. And then you're left really having to negotiate or sort of like smooth the waters when the patient is the primary responsibility, not that son who may be bringing his own family of origin issues from the time he was 12 years old and dad or mom didn't pay enough attention to him. So, I mean, how have you handled, I mean, this is a tough question. I know, but I'm sure you've walked this walk within the context of the hospital a lot.
Yeah. And this is sort of what I was referring to earlier. I mean, it is a challenge, you know, in the hospital for the staff. Oftentimes, you know, we try to treat every patient obviously with compassion and with integrity and focus. But still, for the staff, it is another patient. For the family, this is their one father, their one mother, and they live with the decisions that they make for the rest of their lives. And so even though, you know, we might feel at a certain point, well, this is only going a certain direction and we don't want to engage in what you referred to earlier as futile care, sometimes we recognize also that it needs a couple of days. It needs a little bit of time for people to come to grips with what's happening, and they need to be kind of gently walked through it. And that's what I was referring to before with kind of a reasonable accommodation. Oftentimes we just kind of have to help people through their process and kind of work with them, helping them recognize that which direction it's going, but without kind of slamming the door on them immediately.
Yeah, you raised it, something that's very, I think it's very important and sometimes very subtle, and that's the idea of time. All of us have been involved in situations where sometimes you just have to just step back. I think there's a Talmudic expression, sheva al ta'aseh, which loosely translated into New Jerseyan is sort of like, just wait a minute, don't do nothing. That allows, I think, as you're alluding to, sometimes family members, even the patient themselves, to come to some sense of an acceptance, is to understand maybe news that has been delivered, and just be comfortable with that. And I'm sure that's where your expertise really comes in handy. I mean, walking somebody through that valley of the shadow and to where they can emerge out and to make some peace or accommodation or decision. And that's why, again, I think, as you're alluding to, both of you are alluding to, every case has to be judged on its own merits and in its own way within the own family context. How important, you've alluded to it, Dr. Brandwein, the making sure you have a healthcare proxy, durable power of attorney for healthcare, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and all those forms filmed out and updated on a regular basis. How important is that?
It's extremely important. Now, the actual living will is very difficult to write because you're putting facts down there that can't always be followed, the things that you want. The most important thing you can do is have a durable power of attorney for healthcare. You pick somebody who is able to do that. I was talking to one lady and I said, well, are you going to have your husband do that? And she said, my husband, all he'll do is sit in the waiting room and cry. So you have to have somebody who understands what you want, who will stand up for you, who has the courage to face up to the doctors, to the nursing staff, and say, this is what she wanted, and this is what she's got to do.
Rabbi Wiener, in California, and I think also in New Jersey, but not in every state, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, guys, is the PULST form, P-O-L-S-T. Could you walk me through what that is and why it's so important?
Sure. A PULST is similar to an advance directive, but it's a physician order. So the physician actually makes the order, and it's more specifically focused on specific interventions, DNR, you know, do not resuscitate, and nutrition, hydration, things like that, where we want to make sure that we have on record. It goes with the person. It goes into their medical chart. So if they were to leave the hospital and go to a nursing home or return to the hospital, the doctors, the staff can know right away what is the status of this patient in terms of how aggressively they want to be treated. And it just really helps the staff, the medical team in particular, to know some of these basic facts about the patient when they arrive. Because, you know, usually, and it's not only for the emergency room, but usually when a person arrives to an emergency room, the approach without knowing that person is just to do everything to save their life and then kind of deal with that later.
Right.
But a PULST form, amongst other things, helps us to know exactly what that person wants in terms of medical orders right away.
And am I correct that it's not legal or recognized in all 50 states? Is that correct? Do you know? Hello?
We're thinking. For instance, a living will is not a document binding on the hospital
correct.
Staff.
But the
PULST is. Now, whether all 50 states have that, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's because whenever I go out and teach, I always remind congregants and people in synagogue land, that it's in their best interest to determine in their particular jurisdiction, legal jurisdiction, whether this is a legal document and recognized. So I think in Jersey it is, and I know in California it is because
we have, in some states they have other titles also, like MOLST, medical
right.
order for life-sustaining treatment.
Right.
You know, there's other names.
I think that's in New York State, the MOLST form. Rabbi Wiener, you alluded to in just a little bit before another issue that comes up all the time. And if you could walk us through from your practice, from the tradition's practice, about artificial nutrition, hydration, and the removal of that from a person at the end of life, and some of the tensions that you've seen in your practice.
Yeah, this is a complicated area. It's a challenging area. This is something that has changed in sort of American bioethics, which was basically the question of, you know, is nutrition and hydration seen as a medical intervention, or is it like a basic necessity? And if we see it as a basic necessity, that's something that we want to, you know, provide in most circumstances. If it's a medical intervention, then just like other medical interventions can be removed, so too you would remove nutrition and hydration. In American law today, it's seen as a medical intervention that can be removed. Oftentimes, physicians will argue that it's sometimes even contraindicated. It's bad for a patient who's dying. It causes more pain and suffering. It doesn't prolong life. And so they will advocate for its removal. A number of the great rabbis that dealt with medical ethics issues in the past generations saw nutrition, not all, but many saw nutrition and hydration as a basic necessity of life that enables someone to live and to suffer less. And their approach is that, you know, if someone's dying of a terminal disease, let's say, for example, cancer, and we come to the point where they are dying and we're allowed to allow natural death to take place, we don't have to aggressively prolong life. The goal is that they should die from the illness and not something that we could have prevented. And so from this perspective, where they see nutrition and hydration as a basic necessity, unless it is, as sometimes is the case, unless it is actually causing more pain and suffering, it's not being absorbed, it's actually hurting the patient, they would advocate for it to be continued, at least on a basic, you know, minor level. It doesn't, not necessarily always with through a procedure like a, you know, like a G-tube inserted into their stomach, but it's some sort of nutrition and hydration they will usually advocate for.
We are speaking with the Rabbi Jason Wiener, Director of Spiritual Care at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, about his brand new book, Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision-Making, again, published by Urim, U-R-I-M, available on Urim's website and also on Amazon, and with Dr. Warren Brandwein, who professor of bioethics at Jefferson, right? I made a mistake before. I apologize. I don't want to get involved with those two things. Jefferson Medical School here in Philadelphia. go ahead.
Yes, I would like to ask Rabbi Wiener a question. You're counseling a patient, end of life. Their prognosis is extremely poor. You feel that more treatment is futile. And the family says, wait a minute, we are expecting a miracle and we don't want treatment stopped. We are going to have a miracle. We're praying and you can't stop treatment now. I've run into this. How do you handle it?
Yeah. Excellent question. Because you're right. It's a very common issue that arises. Even with people that don't, you know, present as being, you know, officially religious or observant, but miracle talk becomes common in at the end of life. And what we have found is that, you know, when dealing with people in general, let's say in general you're talking to someone who doesn't agree with you, the first human reaction is usually to try to convert them. I'm not talking about religious conversion. You know, someone has a different political perspective. Usually we don't listen to it. We want to convert them. And then they see us as being, you know, against them. And then it usually doesn't go well because people defend their own beliefs. And we find that first, just from a human interaction perspective, when people are talking about miracles, if we tell them right out, like, well, you know, this is not going to happen, or you know, I've seen this a million times and it never happens, or you need to stop being so irrational, then not only do they just see you as someone who they can't talk to, but they see you as being against God, which is, you know, not a good place to be when you're trying to have a working relationship with someone. So the first thing we advocate for is being together with a person in their hopes for a miracle. It's okay to say something, you know, even for the doctors, something like, you know, I also hope for a miracle. I really do hope that happens. And in the meantime, you know, what are we going to do? Let's talk about, you know, what we're going to plan for just in case. The phrase I often use is hope versus expectation. I think that hope is always appropriate. Hope is always beneficial and helpful for people. But if it becomes excessive, you know, irrational expectation, like I know this is going to happen, that can leave someone really hurt and let down. So there's room for people to hope for a miracle, but to also plan, and recognizing that, you know, any miracle, everyone dies, you know, so what exactly do you mean by the miracle? And we oftentimes will explore that with people, because it can't mean that they hope that the person will stay alive forever. Against all odds, you know, no one's ever stayed alive forever. So as we sometimes talk about it, while we're with them in it, sometimes it can become a little bit more adaptable and something that we can work with. But it's always a challenge.
Dr. Branway raises an issue, though, about prayer. And in your book, Rabbi Wiener, you have a section on the efficacy of prayer, which I found to be really, really nice. And you quote Rav Soloveitchik, I think, in there, that Judaism never promises God accepts all prayers, which I think is a very interesting way of approaching that with an individual, with a family. There may be, especially as you alluded to before, people who are not used to praying, quote unquote, an expectation that, well, I'm going to be praying. And if there, you know, it's the if then. If there's really a God, God will do what I want God to do. But the Soloveitchik quote that you write about, I think is very nuanced and very beautiful. Could you talk to me about that role of prayer in your work from both a professional perspective and, if I may, a personal perspective?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're definitely right. Prayer is central, and it becomes sometimes, you know, especially when you're in a big modern building with all kinds of machines and tools and professionals, and you feel so out of place. Sometimes the one thing that can help a person transcend the boundaries of that medical institution is their relationship with God and prayer. And people feel kind of helpless, and that gives them something to hold on to. What I loved about the Rav Soloveitchik approach to prayer is that he kind of reframes the purpose of prayer. And this I found to be very helpful for people, which is that he argues that the goal of prayer is not to convince God to do what I want God to do. We don't just pray to tell God our demands. Prayer is, the goal is to create a relationship. We do hope that God will do the things that we, you know, we ask from God. I mean, we have this hope that it will somehow work out in the way that we think is best, but we recognize that we don't know best, and God's thoughts are not our thoughts. And so the best thing we can do, at least, is to develop a relationship with the transcendent in the belief that, you know, as it says, Imo Anochi Batzara, God is with us in our times of distress, and God is the Rofe L'Shvuri Lev, the healer of shattered hearts, and that if we can develop a relationship and find support and meaning in that, that hopefully even if things don't go the way we want them to go, we will have something kind of to rely on and help us to get through that struggle.
Yeah, I'm always struck when I teach this to myself, that the daily Amidah in the Shachrit, in the morning service, and the daily repetition of the Amidah, there is this wonderful line which says, heal us, God, and we shall be healed, etc., etc. And the fact that when you teach this to lay people, you remind them, it says, look, here, the Jewish tradition doesn't pray, it prays for healing, does not pray for a cure. And I find that to be, just like along the lines of what you're talking about, just a fascinating insight from centuries ago, that in some way the people who created that understood that it's possible to be healed spiritually, but not be cured of a particular disease. And the power of that, I think, is overwhelming. Let me go back to before we start running out of time, the this whole concept of boundaries, if I may ask the two of you. The Jewish tradition has boundaries, you know, right? Rabbi Wiener, Goseis, Trefa, the demarcating lines upon a life's path when you may move from absolute aggressive care to comfort care, etc. Medical technology has pushed this envelope of what's possible to extreme limits. Rabbi Wiener, Jewishly, regardless of the denomination, do we need to start creating new vocabulary to take into consideration new life stages of people as we live longer and are involved? For example, the Alzheimer's dementia journey, where, you know, which can last, as all of us have seen, you know, not years, but decades. Do we need a new vocabulary in the Jewish tradition to really take into consideration the march of medical technology and new stages of life that because of longevity?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And the truth is, it's not only at the end of life. I mean, this question was debated. There's an excellent book that was published about 10 years ago on reproductive technologies, where there was an interesting debate between Rabbi Bleich and another rabbi from Israel on surrogacy and who is considered the mother according to Jewish law when there's a surrogate arrangement. Right. And, you know, one of them tried to make the case that there are Talmudic analogs and you can find sources to give to show who's the mother. And the other one argued that no, it's impossible. There's no perfect source in the Talmud that gives you this contemporary concept. And actually what you have to do is come up with general Jewish values that we know of. You know, what does it mean to be a parent? What does it mean to love? What does it mean to show affinity or care? And apply that in a general, broader way. It's the same question. You know, this question, if you talk about the end of life, one of the chapters I wrote about the artificial heart,
right,
a new technology that is keeping people alive, walking around, doing daily activities without a heart. They have a machine pumping their blood for them. And then at what point, if you are someone who says that as long as someone's heart is beating, they are alive, so what do you do with this person who has no heart? At what point do you, and, you know, one of the great rabbis that I quoted in there basically said, you know, for this we need a new definition of death for this case, because the old definition doesn't work if you talk about a beating heart meaning being the indication of life. So you're right that I don't know if it's a new vocabulary or if it's just a new way of applying values and issues that have some of them never been considered before.
Right. I mean, one of the beauties of Jewish tradition is, as we all know, is that it is not afraid to reinterpret traditional values and beliefs in light of new realities. And in this particular area of medicine and medical ethics, whether it's at the beginning of life or the end of life, that envelope keeps getting pushed. And the reality is that the tradition across the denomination lines is really starting to, you know, take into consideration as new approaches and redefinitions. Dr. Brandwine, you come out of the beginning of life perspective.
Yes,
right?
my practice has been obstetrics and gynecology
so
for many years.
This explosion in that area, as Rabbi Wiener is alluding to, has its own set of challenges, correct?
Absolutely. There's the classic story of the child with five parents. The parents who want to have a child contract and buy an egg. They contract and buy sperm. By in vitro fertilization, this is put into a surrogate mother. And then the surrogate mother supposedly hands the baby over to this couple. So there's five parents involved. Legally, it's the contracting parents, but I don't know how you determine who is the actual mother. We know that in vitro fertilization, when there's more than two fetuses growing, the chances of all of them surviving are slim. So the recommendation is what we call a fetal reduction, which is right. an intrauterine abortion of one or two of the fetuses. This is a whole new, brave new world of reproduction. Obviously, we don't kill one person to save another person, but to lose three babies when you could end up with one healthy baby certainly raises some questions.
And Rabbi Wiener, you allude to that in the book, correct?
Yeah.
And I'm sure you've dealt with the beginning of life issues at Cedars-Sinai, equally as challenging, correct?
Yeah, definitely. And in some ways, more sensitive, just because of the suffering of the parents, or the desiring parent, the parents who are people who are desiring to be parents, mm-hmm. And you know, it's just a different approach to Judaism, to the role of religion at the end of life. Sometimes people are suffering and they're looking for some kind of guidance. And at the beginning of life, people are suffering and kind of wanting to see, you know, make sure that Judaism is okay with what they want to do. But it's like almost like an obstacle, and they're trying to make sure that they're not stepping on any red lines, to do everything that they can to, and also with confidentiality and sensitivity, to be able to have a child and then to understand who the parent is. It just requires I feel like an extra level of sensitivity and compassion.
Well, you know, in trying to fulfill that first mitzvah of peru or vu, of being fruitful and multiplying, and with medical technology making giving us more choices and more choices, again, it comes back to that individual, that case by case, that mom or prospective dad who may see their entire identity. I'm sure you guys have seen it wrapped up in having that child. And then you factor in, as Dr. Branwell was talking about at the top of the show, the unbelievable cost, because none of this is cheap. Not only physical, financial cost, but emotional cost of this. Rabbi Wiener, you know, you walk into that hospital every single day, you deal with this all day, you take it home, I'm sure, because you just can't leave this at the door. These are human beings who struggle, you hold their hands, regardless of where they are, the families. What's the most challenging aspect of your work, the most challenging the part of what you do at Cedars?
Well, without a doubt, the most challenging part is when children die. It's the most painful and shocking, and, you know, it hits home, and it just seems, feels so unfair, and it definitely hits me the most every time.
How do you deal with that? Because I think part of the issue for doctors and also clergy, rabbis, is when you walk that walk with a family, you take it with you. You just can't leave it at the front door. How do you this is instructive for other colleagues. How do you deal with that? How do you make peace with that?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. We call it secondary traumatic stress disorder, where it's like as if you're going through it, and it leads to burnout and compassion fatigue. And I think there's a couple ways we deal with it. I mean, one is just, you know, a certain emunah or faith that somehow, you know, everything happens, everything is just, and that God comforts and cares for these people, and that somehow in the end of days things will work out. And I do sort of have a belief system that comforts me. But more specifically, one thing that we have in our department, and I know other chaplains do this as well, but we have we're very intentional about self-care. So we even have every chaplain, we have a self-care plan, and we have self-care buddies who we have to check in with 3 times a year. And it's even part of our performance appraisal every year when we get reviewed, that how, you know, that we are working on our self-care plan. So every chaplain, we kind of determine which areas, physically, emotionally, spiritually, are beneficial to us. What we do that provides strength, and then we make sure that we're doing it. So, like for me, for example, exercise is a big thing. Going for a run really helps me to kind of both have the time to think through some of the things, and also just kind of pound it out and get it out of the system. Sometimes doing things that are fun, just intentionally making sure to do something fun, something different, spending time with family, music, things like that. Usually when I'm in my car, I listen to lectures or podcasts. But after a very difficult day in the hospital, or when something especially sad happens, I force myself to listen to some fun music or some soothing music, things like that.
Especially on the freeway.
No, that idea. I live close to the hospital. I have to go on the freeway. That I need self-care for every day.
Right, that's true. Having gotten stuck on many of those freeways a lot. But that self-care buddy thing is a really great idea. The rabbinate should do that more of that.
And the doctors.
Right. I mean, I hear the same thing from docs as well. I mean, the stress and strain of do your students understand, because when they would teach us in rabbinic school that this is, we would look and say, no, we're going to be different. We're always going to be different, But do your students also begin to understand that it just takes 24/7, that it just becomes part of who you are?
There are two things going on. No, they do not understand the emotional toll that it takes. On the other hand, the practice of medicine, the world of medicine is changing. When I went into practice, I was on call 24 hours a day. I had one partner. We'd get every other weekend off. Other than that, we were on call. We were working. The kids today have a job. They work 40, 50 hours a week, and that's it. Right. And when they're not on call, they're not on call, and they are much more attuned to taking care of themselves, of taking time off. For 3 years, I didn't take a vacation. That's not a healthy thing to do, but that was how you built a practice in the bad old days.
Now, I mean, we're seeing the same thing in the rabbi. My students at HUC are much more aware of self-care, and because I think they've seen their previous generation of colleagues, burnout, or as Rabbi Wiener is talking about, just compassion fatigue. In the couple of minutes we have left, I just want to raise one other issue that comes up all the time, and that this concept of quality of life and the role of quality of life in making a decision, regardless of the stage of life. And Rabbi Wiener, could you, because I know there's been an evolution in that in some aspects in some of the denominational structures of Judaism. What's the role in your day-to-day practice of a person's quality of life?
Yeah, it's a good question, because it is something, there are sometimes for some, especially some very traditional Jews, that there are certain keywords that spark suspicion. And sometimes quality of life, when we use that phrase, people start to get, their antennas go up and they say, oh, is this just a code word for, let my loved one die, finish them off because they have no quality of life. On the other hand, you're right. There are more and more rabbis who will use that phrase and recognize that modern technology and the medical interventions we use sometimes just really induce a tremendous amount of suffering that that is almost inhumane when it doesn't have a chance to provide any kind of benefit to the patient. So typically we use quality of life in terms of just the pain and suffering. We are trying to avoid pain and suffering. It's traditionally in Jewish medical ethics, we don't go as far as some others might go. And when they talk about quality of life, if it's the ability to watch my favorite show, if I can't watch that show, that's no quality of life, and I'd rather be dead.
Right.
That might not play a role in Jewish law, but pain and suffering, which are different, because suffering is emotional, and pain is physical. If there's, real pain and suffering, that is something that we do take into account. And we do advocate for quality of life in the face of pain and suffering, though it does not mean ever allowing to actively, intentionally hasten death.
Last word, Dr. Brandwein.
I'd like to ask a quick question, if I may.
You have 2 minutes.
Rabbi Wiener, do you wear a kippah at work?
Yeah.
Does that ever create problems?
I don't know. I can't know what other people are thinking about me. There are times, obviously, when I am called upon in emergencies to help with patients who are not Jewish, or sometimes there are patients who are not observant, and I don't, and they think that I'm going to say certain things because I have to toe the party line, and so I have to go out of my way to kind of help people see that I am there for them. I'm not there to impose anything on them. I don't have any ulterior motives, and that I'm, you know, walking alongside them. So I do sometimes feel an extra burden of requirement to go out of my way to help people recognize that I don't have that bias, but I haven't encountered situations where someone said to me, you know, and most of the patients I work with are not Orthodox Jews, but I don't remember ever hearing someone, you know, to my face at least, tell me that that precluded my ability to provide support for them.
Yeah, I think my experience also in when push comes to shove in those moments, the presence of another person who is compassionate and caring trumps everything else. And I think that's the greatest gift of the chaplaincy, and the greatest gift of the chaplain in a hospital situation is presence and caring and a sense of a spiritual holding that really transcends everything. And I think that's really the gift. Dr. Warren Brandwein, Jefferson University, professor of bioethics, thank you very much. Rabbi Jason Wehner, new book, Jewish Guide to Practical Medical Decision-Making. Thank you very much, Jason. Continued good luck in everything. Haslacha. Have a good holiday. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's an honor to talk to both of you. I really appreciate it.
You take care. And thank all of you for being a part of today's broadcast here on Jewish Sacred Aging Radio. As we've mentioned, these shows are archived as podcast on our website, jewishsacredaging.com. We invite your comments and suggestions. You can send them to rabbi@jewishsacredaging.com. And we'd invite you to like the Jewish Sacred Aging Radio Facebook page. A thank you to our producer at whose studio these shows are produced, Lubetkin Global Media here in Southern New Jersey. Thank all of you for listening. We look forward to greeting you again on the next edition of Jewish Sacred Aging Radio here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Richard Address. Thank you and shalom.